Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hey, good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Wednesday night installment here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies and promoting our speaker's book, I Object. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference, brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do were they similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. It's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure, better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR. The rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course, so it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremedyisinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremedyisinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. If it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social a network, though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. But then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do where I similarly was situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions and all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button, fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. Every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Everett for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not at Your Remedy is in the law anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
All right, that is my ramble for this evening, folks. So without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the call over at this time to Mr. Edward, and he will introduce our speaker for this evening.
Well, thank you so very much, Martin. I appreciate that. Tonight we have the inauguration, the virgin birth of a new information provider here at YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com. And the gentleman is Mr. Slevin. It's like 11 with an SL in front of it, Mr. Slevin. If you appreciate a Germanic heritage there, he enjoys to be called Herr Slevin, but that's okay. I've spoken to him, and I don't hear a German accent, but, you know, that's what he is. That's what he is. So tonight, let me give you a 30, 40,000-foot view of what you're going to hear tonight. Mr. Slevin has developed successfully for a number of years a turnkey business profile that you're able to dovetail into with whatever business it is that you have, and also to consider that this business could be what you do today as an employee. You can also do it this way as well. So I'll let him get into all of the details of it, but the bottom line is this. By arranging your affairs, does that sound like something we do on the Saturday night call with Bernie? Yep. By arranging your affairs in such a way, you can actually employ what Bernie does with the Golden Horseshoe in a pre-mode, a pre-effort mode, by utilizing Mr. Slevin's program first. Now, there is one little difference that I'd like to point out to you. Mr. Slevin's program works with a single entity getting the LLC that you're going to be operating this turnkey business application through. I prefer, for safety reasons, and we get into that later, preferably on Saturday call with Bernie, but to have two charitable religious trusts come in as the co-owners, if you would, 50-50 of the LLC. That's the only thing different that I would be doing myself with his program, only because that then enables me sometime down the road to supplant those two charitable religious trusts that own 50-50 shares of the LLC with foreign grantor trusts out of, say, a country like Belize that has no income tax recognized for anything done outside of their country. And that's that. Now you're slipping right into the Golden Horseshoe that you're all familiar with from Bernie's conversation. So without further ado, it's my sincere pleasure. I'm excited about this. Turn the call over to Mr. Slevin, or Herr Slevin. Yeah, that's you. Hello? Whoop. How'd that happen? I muted him by mistake. My beg your pardon, sir. I mute. Okay. I don't know what's going on here. 1 second here. Let me see if I can work something here real quick. I got some technical difficulty. Bear with me 1 second. It will only take a moment.
Hello.
All right. Mr. Slevin, you there?
I think so. Can you hear me?
Now I can hear you. Wonderful. Okay. Wonderful. Let's not turn this
well,
into
hello,
a Titanic.
Huh?
So did you hear, were you able to hear my 30,000 foot view?
Yes, sir. I heard everything.
Good deal. So let me turn the call over to you and you can explain how this marvelous arrangement of yours works.
Very good. Tell me when.
Now. We're very recording.
Hello, everyone. It is Herr Schlevin here, and I'm having a very good time talking to you. And I'll change accents occasionally just to keep you on your toes. Well, tonight what we would like to talk about is the overall government propensity to lie, obfuscate, camouflage, and otherwise just deceive people. The people that do this in the government are known as lexicographers. A lexicographer, according to the Supreme Court in Merchants Loan and Trust v. Simcannon, says that the a lexicographer twists things, okay? This is the quote at 28. In determining the definition of the word income, thus arrived at, this court has consistently refused to enter into refinements of lexicographers or economists and has approved in the definition quoted what it believed to be the commonly understood meaning of the term, which must have been in the minds of the people when they adopted the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. So the lexicographer twists things to hide a simple situation. A measure of this is called the Flesch Index. That's spelled F-L-E-S-C-H. It goes from 1 to 100. As an example of the Flesch Index, the typical newspaper is written at 8.5. A first-year college student understands at about 11. And a law school graduate comprehends somewhere around 15. The tax code in particular is written at 33 with pieces as high as 55. They have no intention of letting you know what they're saying. So the simplicity that they are hiding in this particular case is explained like this. The Constitution of the United States designates two great classes of taxation. They are direct, which is applied by apportionment, and indirect, which must be uniform throughout the United States. Now, the three categories of taxables are people, property, and activities. Direct taxes are imposed on people and property via census and enumeration. Indirect taxes, which are best described as by the word excise, are placed on activities. However, there must be a way devised to measure the activity, and that has come down through time as the calculating the production of the activity or a flat fee on something necessary to the process. Now, the 16th Amendment states, the Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes, comma, from whatever source derived, comma, without apportionment among the United States, comma, and without regard to any census and enumeration. So leaving out apportionment and leaving out census and enumeration, that leaves out direct taxation by the 16th Amendment. So therefore, it's authorizing Congress to make a tax on income, but it must be an excise tax. Well, income is not an activity, so therefore it can only be the measure of the tax. And we find that that it is a measure in Doyle v. Mitchell, 247 U.S. 179 in 1918. At 185, it says, whatever difficulty there may be about a precise and scientific definition of income, it imports, as used here, something entirely distinct from principal or capital, either as the subject of taxation or as a measure of the tax, conveying, rather, the idea of gain or increase arising from corporate activities. As was said in Stratton v. Halbert, quote, income may be derived as gain derived from capital, from labor, or from both combined, end quote. So when we look at the where this all started, which was the 1909 Revenue Act, which was put together 3 weeks after the 16th Amendment was sent out for ratification by Congress, we find that we have an excise tax upon income with respect to doing business in the corporate capacity. So the case that came about that was called Flint v. Stone Tracy, and they said, yes, this is a good constitutional excise tax on a particular privilege, because I believe it was Madison v. Mayberry that said you can't tax a right. So you can't tax something that you have to do to live, to sustain your right to life. It has to be a privilege. And operating the corporate capacity is also always a privilege, because you have to jump through hoops, you got to get process, you got to get chartered, all that good stuff. However, in Flint v. Stone Tracy, they said that the private individual, private firm, and private partnership are not subject to the income tax imposed. And that's because they can't partake of the particular privilege of doing business in the corporate capacity. So that all comes down today into Section 701 of the Internal Revenue Code, which says, I believe, a partnership as such shall not be subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter, period. Now, the term partnership is also defined. It says over in 7701A2, I believe, in part, it says the term partnership includes an unincorporated organization. And so when we go and get or go to the Secretary of State of whichever union state, but we like to use New Mexico for a variety of terms, and we say, okay, we make the application, and the application requires two parties, the organizer and a registered agent, which must be within the confines of the state of New Mexico. However, both of these parties can be other LLCs. And I'm pretty sure some legislators got paid a whole lot of money to get that written in that particular way. So the once this is applied for, the Secretary of State of New Mexico presents us with a certificate of organization, which goes back to being a partnership, which goes back to being not subject to the income tax imposed, because it falls under the definition of a private firm. And Supreme Court said, yeah, you can't partake in a privilege, you can't be taxed. Great. So this is the basis of what we do. Now so our program, which we call our product, which we call a private firm business, starts out with an application by a prospective client to say, yes, I'd like to have one of your products, and I'd like it to be named, we'll use the moniker XYZ LLC. So the company then goes, or company personnel then go to the Secretary of State in New Mexico, get the make application for XYZ LLC. It's granted, and we have our sister organization, which acts as the registered agent. They're within the confines of the state of New Mexico. And so we handle both of those, both ends of that. And then the a personnel in our organization goes and gets an EIN for XYZ LLC. EIN stands for Employer Identification Number, which is a form of a tax identification number, which most individuals use their Social Security number as a tax identification number. So the new company has a certificate of organization and its EIN. When the EIN is applied for, it is applied for under one of the five ways of getting or reasons for getting an EIN, and it is for banking purposes. Back in the day, this used to say banking purposes only, and that particular one applies. It says something to the effect of, in order to comply with local law or banking policies, I believe. So the EIN is issued for banking purposes only. And then because in 2017, the IRS changed the thing. It used to a one entity could get a new EIN for a second entity. 2017, they changed that, and now it requires a human being with a Social Security number to get that particular type of EIN. So one of our people gets that. And these people are protected because they've never filed a 1040 United States individual income tax return. And by not filing that, the IRS, for all intents and purposes that we've been able to find, has absolutely no jurisdiction over that individual. So therefore, the individual who is represented on the EIN paperwork as a sole member receives the EIN for XYZ LLC, and then that individual holds a meeting as a sole member and commissions a third person as the manager for this new company. A manager is the only officer of an LLC. The LLCs were first formed in 1977, legislated in 1977. They were a combination of the traditional corporation and partnerships, and they changed certain verbiage so that anyone reading that stuff would understand what type of or form of entity we're talking about. The corporation uses multiple officers, such as president, secretary, CEO, board of directors, and so forth. And then partnerships have general partners and limited partners. So the legislators in the various union states says, well, we're going to have one officer. It's going to be a manager. Now, you can have as much verbiage in front of the manager, like chief executive or financial manager or whatever, but manager is the only one. But you can have as many managers as the company requires or desires. So back to our progression, the sole member commissions the manager. The manager then takes those three pieces of paper down to a banking institution, and the three pieces of paper are, again, the certificate of organization, the EIN, and his resolution or commissioning him as manager, which is also known as a letter of authority, presents that to the bank and says, I'd like to have a corporate account for XYZ LLC. The bank says, yay, verily, here you go. And that is boxed up, bring it back to the office, and then we add a pay-as-you-go cell phone with it, and it is programmed with the banking, electronic banking application, and we like to include Square application and Cash App application. Cash App happens to be owned by Square. It is a very easy way of transferring peer-to-peer without any cost. and then the bank, the company costs are very minimal. Square is a point of sale app, and it so the XYZ LLC can now take payments for its product or services via debit card or credit card through the Square app, and then expense those as necessary. Recently, we also were informed about the Square app having a business checking account as well, and you can get a debit card with that. So this is a this has now become a secondary account for the XYZ LLC, and there's also a couple other platforms out there that also that offer that kind of service, in which we will combine as a bundle. And these are both and all of these are give both business checking and business savings. So all that's put together, money's run through it, everything is tuned up, figured out, and then we transfer that box of material to the client who has contracted for said product. And this transfer is completely private because on the Secretary of State of New Mexico, there's no body there, and on the various other things, there's nobody there that's connect in those private in those public venues, the client with this new business entity. Then we offer an integration service because what we've just built is a new business model. So whatever you do today is your business model, as simple or as intricate as that may be. And so this is a brand new shiny thing, entirely independent of anybody else's circumstances. It's all brand new. And then then there's an integration phase. Clients may wish to have to start a whole new line of business using this product, or they may want to dovetail in what they've already got doing, or they may want to do a wholesale transfer over from what they were doing to this new product, whatever it is. Those are all just details. So this integration phase is covered under what we call our hotline services. Hotline services are free for the first year, and then you have an optional subscription that after that at $500 a year. And the client is free to take it or leave it. However, if the subscription is allowed to lapse, then and you call and you go, hey, look, I need this and this done, whatever, then it will be $100 an hour up front, and first hour up front, and then whatever the requirements take. There are other add-ons that can be provided via our company, and like stock trading accounts, crypto accounts, things like that. And we work those out on a one-to-one basis as to how expansive that you would like the private firm to be able to enjoy. That's pretty much it. And as I said, all of the details. Oh, let me make one thing clear. When we transfer to the client, there's a bill of sale involved for the company and its assets and all business aligned by that company. And then we also provide a letter of non-interference. It's similar to a non-disclosure agreement. And basically it says, our company has built this really beautiful thing. It is now yours. It is your business. Here are the passwords. Here are this and here are that. These all need to be changed so that you have absolute control, and that there is no worry that any of our personnel or associates could tamper with XYZ LLC in any way, shape, or form. And we provide if an incident were to happen, it's $1,000 immediately, and then whatever damage was decided upon via mediation that would also be, that's also taken into effect in this, this agreement. So I believe that pretty well lays everything out of our product. And what are your questions?
Most excellent. Thank you so much, Mr. Slevin, Herr Slevin. My first question is, end result is what for the business regarding a tax responsibility out of pocket when done?
Well, the LLC, particularly the ones in New Mexico, are fall under Section 701 of the Internal Revenue Code. A partnership as such shall not be subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter, period. All business bingo. Done under the – say again?
No, no, I just said bingo. Go ahead. All business done.
Yeah, so all – so what that comes down to in reality is that all business – and business is properly defined as the – buying, selling, holding, or handling of goods for with the intent of profit. Okay, so handling and holding would be services. So that is the product, buying and selling products and services. Okay, so. That's business, so none of that business is subject to the income tax imposed in Chapter 1. And now there's other income taxes imposed. However, they're also esoteric because, as I explained from the Flint v. Stone Tracy case, that's what it comes down to. And so I'm sure you're well-informed associates. Have looked at the 1913, 1916, 1918, 1922 income tax codes to see, you know, how did they really do this? And we understand this because we go back to what's called the statutes at large and read it. That's what Congress actually wrote down. And then the president at the time signed off on. Now the lexicographers take that, and I don't recall the exact department that does that. But they take it and then they split off the pieces of legislation and put it in the different areas of the United States Code, of which Title 26 is the Internal Revenue Code. So the so when you read the code today, it may sound close to what the original legislation was, but unless you go back and read that, you don't see the differences. Nonetheless, the LLC falls under the term partnership, which is not subject to the income tax imposed in Chapter 1 or anything else, because it's all about doing business in the corporate capacity. And we also, you know, in 1913, they rewrote the revenue law and they said, okay, they got to drop excise and they say this is a tax upon income and then of 1% or whatever it was. So they got to leave off the with respect to. Now, that phrase reappeared in the 1935 Social Security Act, and it says it was done in 11 separate titles because FDR knew that they put it – if they one of the titles fell, then they could keep everything up. So in Title 8, I believe it is, the what is now FICO is stated, and it says – there is hereby imposed a tax upon income with respect to employment. Well, everybody knows what employment means, right? No, because the lexicographers then went over in Chapter 11 and they said the term employee includes the officer of a corporation. And in the very next section, it says something to the effect of, the terms includes and including shall not be deemed to exclude other things otherwise within the term defined. And if you analyze that little piece of twisting, you will note that there's about three sets of double negatives in it, which says, which then makes the definition read, the terms includes and including shall be deemed to only be what is in the term defined. So when we look at the Chapter 11 of the definition of employee, it says that it is the officer of a corporation, which ties it right straight back to the 1909 law, and now you have it all in a nice little bundle. Did that answer your question?
Beautiful. Yes, it does. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, short story. When I was 16 years old, I left our family's small quarter horse ranch in South Florida. Tired of stinking up myself and being stunk and all that went with it. And I went to work for Zale Corporation. And Zale Corporation viewed me as an employee. I viewed myself as an apprentice getting paid to learn a trade. Totally different mindset. And the 8 years that I was with Zale Corporation, I learned their business model to the place and point where I owned it. Point in fact, and I'm not saying this in a thing to brag, but just to, as a matter of fact, that when I turned 21, I was awarded my own store as a manager. I was the youngest manager in the chain. And for the next 3 years running, I won the what's called the Diamond Z Award for the southeast region of the United States. The whole United States was divided into six regions, southeast, northeast, northwest, you know, got it. So anyways, after 8 years, I talked family into backing me, and I was able to borrow $25,000. And with that $25,000, I was able to leverage a $100,000 loan at the bank. So I had $125,000 capital, and I went and opened up my own business directly across a courtyard from my former employer. And I hung a little sign out that said, I mean, not a little sign. It was I think it was 3 foot by 15 feet, something like that. It was the width of my storefront that said, I don't care what the price is, I'll beat theirs by 10% and pay the tax. They lasted 11 months, and they closed their doors. The point that I'm making here is that if you have a CDL license and you drive a truck, why not make that, and let's just use Michael Edward. Instead of making Michael Edward an employee of that trucking company, how about that trucking company hires Edward Transports, LLC, so that they're paying Edward Transport, LLC, instead of paying Michael Edward. And their benefit is that they don't have to mess with the bookkeeping. It's just a straight expense, and there's nothing involved with insurance. Is there anything else? I've got to cover my own gig on that. But I get 100%. One divided by one is one. And so to the people that are listening on this call right now, you may be an entrepreneur and you're going to go create a brick and mortar, or you're going to go do something on the internet where you're, you know, have stores on the internet and you're working through Amazon and other places, or you might be someone that works for someone. And this is the opportunity to create a different entity for that company you presently work for to hire directly. And I just want to make those suggestions to you as well. The first person raving a question is Anne Marie. Go ahead. Your phone is unmuted, followed by Michael in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Good evening, everyone. I did have a question in regards to banking. If I understood what I heard correctly, that the manager of the LLC opens your bank account. Here, my experience in the United States, the manager is the controlling party of the bank account. They have access to all of the banking account. So once that's completed, what protections do we have that the manager is not going in and controlling your account?
Well, as I said, we do a contractual way of saying it. We won't touch it. But then we give you all the passwords and the phone that's connected through it and that uses for the authentication so that it, other than specifically going in to a branch and saying, okay, yeah, I want to do something with this account, which we state, empirically that we won't do it and we contract that way. Then there's no way for the manager of, in our example, XYZ LLC to mess with the account. And this is one of our points of process, because this is the question that usually comes up right off the bat is like, okay, well, can't you take my money? Okay. So, and this is where I'd like to explain something. This is the way banks really work. All right. When an individual representing a company or not walks in and hands cash to a teller at a bank and says, put this in my account, they take it and they make a notation in the account, but that cash becomes the property of the bank. It goes on their asset list. Okay. So mm-hmm. when you come back and, excuse me?
I said, mm-hmm, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm agreeing.
So when the depositor comes back and says, okay, here's a check. I want you to pay Joe's Laundry down here $500 because they did a service for me. Then that is a claim on the cash, and the banks normally honor those claims and provide the cash to the recipient, the guy on the pay to line of the check. All right. So I'm sure you've all been aware that, the IRS comes in and seizes your bank account. Well, that's not what they do. They present to the bank a higher claim in the bank's eyes than the depositor. Okay. So then the bank looks at it and go, oh yeah, you got a higher claim. Here you go. Here's all of our cash because this lower claim depositor can't do anything about it. So, that's the truth of banking. And a couple of things that have happened, particularly in 2008, I believe it was the Dodd-Frank Act. Banks now, if there is a declared emergency and they don't have the cash or they don't wish to hand out the cash, they can provide the depositor with bank stock instead of cash at whatever level it's being traded at that point. The other piece of that thing that usually impacts individuals, if there's a declared emergency, and the depositor wishes to go in and access what he's put into the safe deposit box in the bank's vault, there has to be a DHS, Department of Homeland Security, person standing there with them when they open that box just to see what's in it.
Mm-hmm.
So those are a couple of the things that we must understand when we go and deal with banks so that you can, the great adage is forewarned is forearmed. Does that answer your question?
Yes, and if I may, I'd like to ask a second question. So if I wanted to add someone on the banking account, I would therefore have to have the manager do that?
Yeah, well, okay, is that the entirety of the question?
Yes.
Okay, so yes, as part of the transfer paperwork that our company provides to the client, we provide whoever the client and or their designate is with a manager's commission. So they have all the same paperwork that the original manager uses in their possession so they can go open as many financial accounts for the company as necessary. The original checking and or savings account, excuse me, we have processes in place to add the designate on that checking account and or then also remove the original manager from that checking account. All those processes in place, it's just a matter of details.
Okay.
That answer your question?
Yes, it did. Thank you so very much. Appreciate
You're
it.
You're very welcome.
Wonderful. Thank you, Anna Marie. Next is Michael from Las Vegas, Nevada.
You quoted court cases from before 1933.
Yes.
And since Social Security started in 1933.
Actually, 1935, yes.
Yes. They don't, the federal government has tried to eliminate using any court cases from pre-1935. And that's,
okay.
They don't want those brought, up in action. But I'm sure there's a way around it. The other thing is, the 16th Amendment, my understanding is that Congress has they have the authority to exercise taxes, to tax, but they only have that authority on their corporation, not on individual people from the individual states, freely associated compact states. But if I'm in Florida, can I file that same corporation in Florida, or does it have to go through New Mexico?
All right. Some multiple conclusions here. But anyway, the reason that our company uses New Mexico is, as I stated in my earlier explanation, the two parties that are on the application to organize an LLC can be other LLCs, right? So there's
right.
never anybody's name on a thing. You can, you can do it in Florida. You can do it in Wyoming, Nevada, Delaware. Those are Wyoming, Nevada, and Delaware are the three main ones where most people get their LLCs done, because they protect the list of incorporators or members, whatever, depending on the form of the business. In New Mexico, there's nothing to protect because it's a couple of other LLCs. And so you can see how this can be stacked. So an LLC organizes one LLC who organizes number two LLC who organizes number three LLC, and in each of those stages, the registered agent, whose only job is to receive process in case the LLC is sued or there's litigation of some type. That's the only job of the registered agent, which can be another LLC, which can be another LLC. Do you see how this can be stacked in bulwark force fashion? So if somebody wanted to sue XYZ LLC in our example, they would have to go and find this, and it would be another LLC. Then they'd have to go back to court and find that, which would be another LLC, and so forth and so on. So what this does is it builds major obstacles to any kind of litigation against the LLC. And then we put in the other piece, because when our company transfers it to the client, the paperwork is not found anywhere except our safe and your safe. And our safe is real hard to get into. What you do with your safe is, that's it. But that's the anonymity and privacy that we build into our product. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I like it. It's because your explanation of the banking and the way they write the tax code, these people that write the tax code are summarily, they're actually committing fraud, but in a roundabout way. And
no, they're not. Everything they do is absolutely legal. But what happened was it may be the corporate United States, and that can be another discussion somewhere else. But the United States, in their administration of the United States of America, had to leave a place for private individuals to do commerce without any hindrance. And that's what Flint v. Stone Tracy says. So it's there. They had to do it, but they have, and I think in one of our articles we say that there has been a moon of camouflage applied upon this venue. Nonetheless, that is the reality of it. Go ahead.
Well, I understand that because in their code it's written you can't interfere with commerce. And interfering with commerce is against the law, whatever kind of commerce it is.
Yes.
So this is very interesting. So how much does all of this cost?
$7,500.
Correct. Okay. And that's coming in with your single, you being the party to creating the LLC. And as I had said at the front of the call, I would be encouraging, dare say pleading with you, to come in with two foreign grantor trusts, which the IRS for the last near 30 years has identified as a, quote, non-taxpayer, end quote, in their adjudications. So that's, you know, if I were actually doing this, I've already got my golden horseshoe set up, so it's kind of moot. But if I were doing this, I would be coming in with two CRTs create the LLC with. Anyways, that's just me. Anybody else? Press star 2 on your keypad.
Michael. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Anybody else? Press star 2 on your keypad, please, to raise your hand. We don't want to have a short call tonight when we could just have a wonderful time and go to town with this. There's lots of questions. I'm sure I see people that I've spoken with earlier this week that were looking forward to this call. You should ask some questions. There we go. I knew I'd bring you out. Hello, Kent.
Good evening. Can you hear me okay?
Perfectly.
Okay. When you talk about using this entity as a employee or someone who's presently an employee, how would this not, in certain cases, let's say somebody was working in a factory or something, and they went to the same location every day, they had a locker there, they changed their clothes there, et cetera. How would this not, if someone like that were to use this and have a contract with that employer to pay them, how would this not smack of some of the things that the IRS looks for example, with an independent contractor saying, well, they're really not an independent contractor because there's a nexus here, there's another nexus over here. In fact, there's a whole lot of nexi. Could you talk about that a little bit, please?
Sure. So the situation you described is known as an employer-employee situation, often referred to as a W-2, okay? A W-2 is the form that the employer gives to the IRS and to the employee at the end of the year or at the beginning of the year after the tax year has ended, which states that, you know, the employee had income of X amount of dollars and with these deductions, so forth and so on. So that is the contract between employer and employee. Just in case you want to know, if you go to look in section 7701, I believe it may be number C, there's a definition of employee, and it starts out like something like the term employee, and then it goes on to a 109-word ramble and comes down to, says, includes a full-time life insurance salesman for the purposes of dot, dot, dot. Okay? So just in case you really think you're an employee, you might want to go read a few of the definitions there in the code. Nonetheless, so the employee-employee relationship is contractual. And I'm sure the associates out there will know that contract makes the law. So the employee and employer contract association. So we'll use the full-time life insurance salesman's thing, and he goes back to the employer and says, hey, look, And, you know, I understand how things work a little bit. And so what I'd like to do is I'd like to rework the contract. So we're going, instead of having an employee to employer contract, we're going to have the company, which will say it's Prudential Insurance. And Prudential Insurance is going to then contract with XYZ LLC for the services of what used to be known as an employee, full-time life insurance salesman. So that contract is negotiated. This has been done by our company and facilitated by our company. It works. And the easiest way to get a quote-unquote employer to look hard at this is to explain to him what's called the burden rate. The burden rate is the bottom line that an employee costs the employer. It is typically 1.5 to 1.6 times the salary of the employee. So the employee says, hey, look, you know, we'll use round numbers here. Look, you know, you pay me $100,000 a year to do what I do. And I know because of the burden rate, that's costing you $160,000. So what I'd like to do is to renegotiate this contract between Prudential and XYZ LLC, and you're going to get the same guy, the same personnel, same great job, reports to the same people, whatever, except the contract will now be between Prudential and XYZ LLC. That means, and it's going to be for $120,000 a year. So what you're going to do is cut one check per month of $10,000. Prudential will cut the check, and on the check, it'll be made out to XYZ LLC. And that's all the bookkeeping you've got to do. And if you want to do 1099 at the end of the year, XYZ LLC will provide you with a W-9 so that you have the information in which to generate your 1099s and send them to whoever you'd like to. But you don't have to worry about any of the other stuff, and it's going to cost you roughly 30% less or $40,000 less for the same guy doing the same job in the same place, and both of you get to be very successful. Mr. Prudential, how does that sound to you?
Let me add to what Mr. Hare Slevin said. Again, when I had the store, my retail store, once a month, this older gentleman, he would be younger than me today, this older gentleman, retired, would back his truck up to my front door and offload carpet shampoo material. And after the store closed, he would come in, put all my chairs on top of the counters that the jewelry was held into, and he would do a jam-up job cleaning the carpets once a month. And I paid his company. I wrote a check every month when he finished his job. And he would deposit that and go about his business. He was a one-man operation. When you called the company on the phone, he answered the phone. And if somebody needed to take out the garbage at his office, place of work, it was him that took the garbage out. So you get the idea here. Anyone can become their own entrepreneur, their own business, even within something that otherwise would not be normally considered outside an employer-employee relationship. Anything else, Ken?
Well, so in other words, this one former employee, with the term employee, this one could work for just this one entity, not like you're mm-hmm. suggesting with this fellow that went around and cleaned different places or whatever, could work for one entity, and it would not be questioned as to, or should not be questioned under the law, as to whether or not this is really one employer with one employee relationship. That's what I wanted to get to that point.
Yes, that's true. Because Kent, we'll use you as an example. So if you were the proposed client that got XYZ LLC and you worked for Prudential or IBM or whatever, and so because XYZ is not connected to you in any public forum or accessible record, then there could be no alter ego association done by the IRS or some other government entity saying that, oh, well, that's just you over here, because all the paperwork shows our company did this and our company did that, and this guy over here got the EIN and that guy over there, gal over there, actually opened the account, dot, dot, dot. So that's the kind of anonymity that we build into this. So that provides for the client being able to use the XYZ LLC or whatever as a contracting entity for their services without any of those pesky things happening.
All right. So let me ask, I'm satisfied with that answer. Let me ask the next question. So when, if we were to use Michael's example of setting up the, what your plan is with charitable religious trusts and having them own the operation, mm-hmm. then the funds go to the LLC. One still has to, whether they're doing this in the employee scenario that you're suggesting, or they're actually running another business as a quote-unquote entrepreneur, they still have to be able to get the funds out, and we're talking about tax avoidance here and not tax evasion. So
correct.
In getting those funds out, if that party or that man or woman, let's put it that way, was still had a nexus to the United States and was a federal citizen, they would still at that point in time have at least some of the problems. I realize that they would have an LLC and there would be certain deductions for that entity, et cetera, but they would still have certain problems in obtaining that money in a tax-free status. Now, is my next conclusion correct? Unless they have now separated themselves or corrected their status and become an American national, would that be basically what the whole program is, top to bottom?
Becoming the American national would be the ultimate in the scenario you described. However, here again, in our example, XYZ LLC is not subject to the income tax. All business done into there is not subject to the income tax. Therefore, there is no third party reporting on that money. Okay, so the money comes in from the contracts that XYZ bills with the various other entities or people in commerce. It comes into the company account. The manager then directs the expense of that cash. That manager, because the company itself is not subject to the income tax, and when you say that, that also means you don't have to keep receipts, you don't have to check your mileage, you don't have to – all the other junk that goes along with being subject to the income tax is not required by XYZ LLC. So there is no third-party reporting of the funds that may be expensed from XYZ to the household expenses of the client, if you will. So that's one cutout. Because third-party reporting, which is normally done by W-2s, 1099s, 1098s, and K2s and some of the lesser ones, that's how the IRS really gets all their information. So if that doesn't appear, then the business becomes invisible to the IRS because the IRS has no authority over it because it's not subject to the income tax. Does that answer your question?
Well, let me just pursue that a little further. You had said prior, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I'll stand corrected, you had said that it's likely that an quote-unquote employer is going to want to generate a 1099 to cover their expenses, and so therefore you would provide them with a W-9 from the XYZ entity so
yes.
they could generate a 1099. This has long been a question regarding the sale of property that are in corporate names and whether a 1099 has to be generated and whether or not it creates some kind of reporting requirement that they then draw a nexus to some other parties, be they corporate officers, et cetera. Now, I realize what you're saying is that you're making this very private and it's hard to tie all this together, but I can still see in certain circumstances that one would be dealing, and I'm not trying to be difficult about this. Maybe this is a little bit of devil's advocate, but I'm trying to determine here. It seems to me that somehow there could be a trail left here and this could get tied together, putting aside 1098s and K2s and some of the other ones that you mentioned. This could be tied together very simply through a W-9 and a 1099. And as I said, this has long been a question in the real estate business when at closing tables, certain attorneys demand that 1099s be issued even when the sale is with a corporation. So, you know, this is an ongoing problem in this country because different people read different things, and a lot of people and a lot of attorneys are trying to cover their butt, so they do what they think the IRS wants them to do rather than what they're required to do. So I kind of asked that question in that regard because it's very often other things happen than really need to happen or happen by law. They just happen because that's the only way people will do it.
Yes. So to be explicit in our terminology, when you used the word corporate name, that belays an incorporation which is subject to the income tax. Okay.
Let me clear that up a minute. There are certain things in the code. I don't know if it's changed recently, but there are certain things in the code where there are no reporting requirements for certain activities, and I'm sure to quote what you said before, somebody paid a lot of money to get this written into the codes, but there are no reporting requirements in certain activities where it would be ordinarily considered that profit is made if it's a filed corporation with a Secretary of State.
This is true here again, but the overall reaching is Section 701. The partnership as such shall not be subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter, period. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. So in our scenario, Joe the plumber works for somebody and he institutes in the XYZ LLC between his old employer. So the old employer then gets a W-9 from XYZ LLC, and so they make up the 1099 as a result of that at the end of the year to cover their shown expenses in that particular relationship. Then the 1099 gets sent to the company, to XYZ LLC at its company headquarters, and then the other copy goes to the IRS. The IRS takes a look at it and goes, oh, that's nice, and they literally drop it in the trash can because they know that that LLC is not subject to the income tax, and therefore they have no place to settle that 1099 with. Okay? There's no account to settle it with. So they literally throw it away because it is moot. There's nothing to it. Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes sense, and I've actually heard that being done in the corporate scenario that I suggested to you.
And that may be. But here again, according to what Congress wrote down, corporations and working in the corporate capacity is what the income tax is upon. Nonetheless, but all of this sets up a lack of third-party reporting on what Joe the plumber or the full-time life insurance salesman gets as revenue for providing excellent service to XYZ LLC on the at the contracted place. What the full-time life insurance salesman does with the funds that XYZ hands to him in as revenue for his service, his or her service, is their business. Now, as we've asked earlier, whether it would be the, you know, becoming an American national and everything, and making sure that that you're totally off the radar as far as that goes. And this is where this comes down to. Okay, the federal judiciary has come to believe with vehemence that anyone filing a 1040 U.S. individual income tax return by signing it and sending it to the IRS is accepting liability for the income tax for life. That is neither legal, lawful, nor moral. But they get paid a tremendous amount of cash to do this. And if you ever want to understand how that works, look up something called a court registry investment system, Chris. Because Chris is the thing that Congress gave to the federal judiciary to pay them off, to do, to keep taxpayers enslaved, for lack of a more inclusive term. Does that get around to everything that you wanted to know?
I think that covers it for now, and I appreciate your answers and the detailed response that you gave. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you, Kent. Next is Jennifer. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Hi.
Hey.
Well, I'm already an insurance agent, and I get paid with a 1099, and I've given for W-9. What would be different? I'm a bit of a slow learner. I have to hear the same thing over and over again.
Well, so you're an insurance agent, and you're working for a company that provides insurance to the public. All right, so that's the contractual.
I can work with any company, basically, and I get a 1099. So any company, I get a 1099 at the end of the year from every company I've done business with.
Yeah. Okay. So the contracts between what is now you in your private capacity and those various insurance companies, that contract would be reworked. So it would be, instead of you and them, it would be XYZ LLC, as I did in our example. Okay, so the contract would be reworked, and then a new W-9 would be filed showing XYZ LLC and its EIN, and then the insurance companies at the end of the year, you know, you're still the human doing the work, but the contract now reads Prudential and XYZ LLC or State Farm and XYZ LLC and so on and so forth. So that contractual negotiation is something that we can help with, because, like I said, we've done it and we've facilitated it. So it's just all a matter of negotiation and getting the proper numbers in the hands of the insurance company. So when the 1099 is written, it goes to the XYZ LLC. And then when that gets to the IRS, they go, oh, that's nice, and throw it in the trash can.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense?
Okay. Now, my son and daughter are son-in-law, they're all W-2 workers, afraid of doing anything and the IRS and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So they work for, well, two of them work for huge corporations. Mm-hmm. And so would the huge corporations care about, plus they want health insurance, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So where does health insurance come into this? Even though, to me, that's valuable to them.
Yeah. Well, life is all about doing what's called a risk to reward matrix. Okay. And you know, and when we're talking a big picture, the probability of somebody who's afraid taking full advantage of our product is very, very limited. And if people are afraid, they tend not to think, and they tend to just do what they're told, and okay, I can get by doing this and I'm fine and nobody will bother me. Okay, that's what the fear does to them. You know, it's like the dog that cowers every time you snap your fingers because you slapped him two or three times after you snapped your fingers. So that's a learned behavior. And trust me, Americans have been insinuated on this from birth that every dime which comes into your pocket is income and it is taxable. That is the bottom line that everybody knows. Okay.
Right. Yep.
And I will tell you a caveat. That's how people that are brought into court on tax evasion or failure to file or whatever, they're not tried on the law. They're tried on what everybody on that jury knows. And because everybody knows you got to pay taxes, and this clown didn't because he didn't want to, and that's tax evasion. Ta-da, conviction.
Right.
So that's the game that has been rigged. So what we have here is, yeah, it's a situation. It's like you're on a train. You're on a track. There's a train coming. You need to get off the track. Oh, no, if I go just slow and I'll lean this way and the train will miss me. That's the kind of thing that people that are in fear think about. And most people, because they can't experience that visceral fear very often, they go into a cognitive dissonance. And so when somebody like me walks up and goes, hey, look, this is how you do it, and you can be successful and the IRS can't bother you, they look at you and go, oh, man, that's sketchy. No, you're going to get in trouble. Oh, I couldn't do that. And that's what you get. So there's a great adage that says success is the greatest revenge. So therefore, I would suggest, and oh, by the way, as the beginning of the program had this caveat, one thing we always say from our company standpoint is we never give advice. Never, 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 never. We simply suggest what we believe to be beneficial tactics and techniques in this venue. So you have this situation with your children and their spouses. You get your stuff done. You get it all. You become radically successful and then go, hey, look, kids, you know, this is available to you. And, you know, I know the people that can do this. That would be my suggestion.
Well, there's only one problem with that. But first of all, I'll tell you that after I ask about where does the WHN come in versus the W-9? Because I thought at some point people were talking about if you're a W-2 worker, you want to give the employer, your W-8 Ben rather than your W-9. Does that come into anything?
Here again, this is those different things are for people that are contracting.
Okay.
Because this is an entity contracting with another entity. Then the W-9 is the only one that matters. I mean, there's always exceptions, you know, nothing's ever always or nothing's never, never. So, you know, but that would be my suggestion. It would be to consult a tax professional, on that particular product.
Right. Okay. Well, I was going to say, all my business came from my online blogs and website, and they have all been removed from online, and they say they haven't saved anything and I can't get any of it back. So I actually have no way of earning money right now. So,
okay, you're using a lot of pronouns. Who removed it?
The company that merged domains, the person who the company that runs the websites and the blogs that you pay every year, and like
okay,
I
so
was,
the internet the site provider, the IP
site,
provider.
I was being back in 2009. I was being what do you call it? Google was playing around. Because every product that I've sold online is something that it's like the banks don't like, the big pharma doesn't like, the everything was something that sort of was out of the box and like becoming your own banker. The banks didn't like, they went after every company. And then, and the last straw was I put good things that Trump had done all over my blogs and website. And literally, now everything is gone. Nothing left.
We've had really good success with a company called Vistaprint. They keep their servers offshore. And so you can't, somebody out in the world can't find out who did the contract with Vistaprint to put up that website. And as far as I've told, various other, we'll use the word entrepreneur, various other entrepreneurs, that I'm in contact with or our company's in contact with, have had good success with, no cancel culture exists at Vistaprint to my knowledge.
That's
one suggestion.
The problem is, like, I was online since 2008, and it matters how long you're online for. It matters. I wrote articles every day, every week. I had so much information, and I was out there. I can't get all that time back and all those people and being found easily, whereas if I start all over again, it's just going to be, I don't even know if I could do it.
You were robbed, to put it simply. You were robbed of your intellectual content and of your voice in the town square.
Yeah.
And that is only one of the voluminous amount of crimes that have been perpetrated on we the people.
I know.
My condolences.
Yeah. Happened to. Sorry, go ahead.
I said my condolences, and I understand where you are, and I understand how that affects it because I've been robbed quite vindictively myself.
Yeah. I mean, even Facebook, I couldn't even post anything because the post would immediately disappear.
Yep.
That happened for a while before everything was taken down.
Yep.
Anyway.
Yeah, so there are several more conservative, if you will, parallel economy kind of thing. A guy named Dan Bongino, can get a lot of information if you go to his broadcast and stuff like that. As far as using parallel economies, parallel to Google, parallel to Facebook, parallel to PayPal, and that's
all. Oh, yeah, I know. I know all that, but I just don't know if I have it in me to start all over again.
Risk to reward. You know, what's your risk? What's your energy level? That's kind of a decision you got to make. Or could you? Or could you get one of our products and we could get you back online with the insurance, you know, that would be something you'd have to look at.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, thanks a lot. It sounds like a great thing.
You're welcome.
If I could get my kids to look at it.
Here again, success is the greatest revenge.
Or their bosses, because one of my sons has a boss that I think, you know, he has a small company. If only Eric would give me his information and I could see if he would you know, look into all this. But anyway.
Sure.
All right. Thanks a lot. I'll let someone else talk.
Michael? Hello?
Oh, I am. Can you hear me?
There you are. Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay. You said the Criminal Reinsurance Corporation, the court's reinsurance or registered insurance?
No, it's called the Court Registry Investment System.
Court Registry Investment System.
Yes, CRIS for short, CRIS.
Right. I've heard the term CRIS. I didn't know that's okay. The Court Registry Investment System. So the Criminal Reinvestment System is what it is, because courts are operating for a profit, and that's against the law. They're violating the law. Yeah.
Agreed.
Anyway, yeah, there's a lot to learn, and there's a lot of people sitting there listening, but they just, I don't know. A lot of people are in fear of just doing it. They become like a rabbit in the fox's mouth. They become paralyzed. They don't realize they can bite back.
True.
But that's not me.
Congratulations.
All righty. Thank you so much, everyone. It was a great inaugural call tonight. I thank Herr Slevin for his wonderful presentation. Great questions from the people on the call. If you have interest in pursuing a private conversation with Mr. Slevin with regards to your particular interest, don't hesitate to reach out to me. My phone number publicly is 800-625-4250. Again, that number is 800-625-4250. And I'll be glad to make the private introductions for you that way. Herr Slevin, thank you, sir, for your call tonight.
You're welcome.
And, thank you. And we look forward to you returning a week from now. And this will be where you anchor yourself. And everyone on the call tonight, I ask you to invite your friends, bring them back here, and let them hear this good news as well. And basically, at the 30,000-foot view, what this does is it makes it very affordable to preempt, if you would, the Golden Horseshoe with this product. And then at a later time when the finances are available, I'm one that believes in overkill. I mean, what? You want a 10-round, you know, 10-round magazine? No, I want the 30-round magazine, and I want six of them. Overkill. Because in setting up this arrangement, you've got this perfectly put in place, and then following behind that, you've got two charitable religious trusts that each receive half of the proceeds from the LLC, and then later foreign grantor trusts will step in behind those two CRTs, and now you're into the Golden Horseshoe, and so you're arranging your affairs in such a way at so many multiple levels, and each one is a plus for you. Each one has its own zero tax responsibilities. So that to me is the way to do things. Anyways, thank you again, Mr. Slevin, and till next week, good night, everybody, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you.